Imagine stepping into a boxing ring.
Okay.
The lights are blinding, the crowd is dead silent, and you look down at your hands expecting to see those heavy leather gloves.
Right.
But instead, you're armed with absolutely nothing. Just a sheet of paper, a pool of water, and some raw pigment.
Yeah, because your opponent in this ring isn't another person at all.
No.
I mean, it is physics itself. You're going head to head with the Earth's gravitational pull, the relentless ticking clock of evaporation, and just the totally untamable behavior of fluid dynamics.
It's a matchup where taking hits is absolutely guaranteed. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we're stepping into that exact arena to dissect a really, truly fascinating artwork. The piece is called 126, and it's by the artist Jero Duke.
Right. It's part of his larger project, Trasteo Pintura Artistica.
Exactly. And the mission for our conversation today is to really unpack the profound artistic philosophy happening beneath the surface of this piece.
Because the moment you look at it, you're just hit with this massive question, right?
Yeah, like, are we witnessing an artist who has bravely surrendered to intentional chaos, or
are we looking at a masterpiece of strict, calculated structural design?
Yes. And that push and pull is just the ultimate engine of the work.
It really is. But to even begin answering that question, we kind of have to ground ourselves in the physical reality of what this object actually is.
Right, the specs.
Yeah. 126 is not some sprawling, immersive mural meant to overwhelm you with its scale.
No, not at all.
It was created in February of 2024, and it is remarkably intimate. I mean, it's just 11 by 15 inches.
Oh, wow. That is small.
Very intimate. And the crucial detail here is its deliberate avoidance of any traditional imagery.
So no reference image whatsoever.
Exactly. The artist isn't painting a recognizable landscape or a figure or, you know, a still life. He is entirely prioritizing the raw interaction of the physical materials themselves.
Which is wild, because by removing that safety net of drawing a recognizable object, he kind of leaves himself with nothing to hide behind.
Nothing at all.
So to understand how he battles these elemental forces without traditional imagery, we really need to understand the physical space and the materials.
Right, the literal arena where this fight goes down.
Yes. So the documentation shows this piece was created in Whittier, California.
Ah, California.
Right, and the instinct whenever we hear California is to immediately fall into this romanticized trap.
Oh, absolutely. We picture the famous West Coast light, the breezy community vibes.
Yeah, the ocean air subtly influencing the artist's brushstrokes.
But the source material forces us to completely reject that romantic notion.
Completely.
This artwork has absolutely nothing to do with California vibes or, like, ambient inspiration. Whittier, in the context of this specific piece, well, it functions strictly as a physical laboratory.
A laboratory. So not a sunny studio.
No, it's a closed, delimited space where chemical and physical reactions are instigated and observed.
Yeah.
It functions more like a petri dish than a window looking out at the world. It's a microscope pointed entirely inward at the artist's own procedural mechanics.
I love that. And, you know, treating the studio as a laboratory means the equipment matters intensely.
Oh, it's everything.
The artist uses a very specific support for this piece. It's a 300-gram cold-pressed Arches paper.
Right. And for anyone who hasn't physically handled 300-gram watercolor paper, it is crucial to understand that this is not, you know, that flimsy material sitting in your desktop printer.
No, not even close.
The sheer density of it changes the entire dynamic of the medium. I mean, 300-gram paper is incredibly thick. It borders on the rigidity of cardboard.
Yeah, it's hefty.
And it's manufactured from 100% cotton rather than wood pulp, which makes it exceptionally resilient.
Which has to be a vital, calculated choice for a piece like this, right?
Oh, completely. Think about it. When you flood a standard sheet of paper with water, the cellulose fibers expand unevenly.
Right. The paper buckles. It warps into these weird hills and valleys.
Exactly. And eventually it just disintegrates into mush. But this specific Arches paper, it's heavily sized with gelatin.
Sized with gelatin.
Yeah, it's engineered to take an absolute beating. It refuses to warp or dissolve, even when completely inundated with standing pools of water.
So going back to my intro, choosing an insanely heavy gelatin-sized paper like this is the exact equivalent of building an ultra-reinforced boxing ring.
I see where you're going with this.
You make the boundaries, the ropes, the canvas totally indestructible for a very specific reason.
Right.
You build a fortress of a perimeter so you have the absolute freedom to let the most savage, chaotic fight happen inside it.
Without burning the whole building down.
Yes. You secure the arena so you can unleash total chaos.
Well, securing the perimeter to invite chaos is a compelling framework, but we do have to consider how much chaos the artist is actually inviting here.
See, I firmly believe this piece is a triumph of artistic vulnerability.
Really?
Yeah. By renouncing the dry tip of a brush, you know, the traditional tool that gives an artist that microscopic dictatorial control over a canvas, the artist just lets pools of water form.
He does let them form.
Right. He lets the watercolor be what it naturally wants to be, which is completely capricious.
Okay, I hear you.
The pigment breaks apart on its own, leaving these highly irregular, unpredictable drying patterns. He sets the stage, sure, but then he steps back and surrenders to the chaos of fluid movement.
I get that red, but the narrative of total surrender starts to fracture a bit when we examine the artist's own documentation of his process.
How so?
Well, he describes the behavior of the color in this piece using three very deliberate words. He states the color is forced, contained, and then liberated.
Forced, contained, liberated.
Yeah. And those are simply not the words of a creative who has completely surrendered to random fluid movement.
That's a fair point.
I mean, you cannot force and contain physical matter without exerting a tremendous amount of structural control over it.
So you're saying it's a trick?
Essentially, yes. What appears to be this chaotic clash of elements is actually a brilliant illusion. It's a masterclass in hydrodynamic manipulation.
Wow, hydrodynamic manipulation. That is a very heavy term to apply to watercolor painting.
It is, but it's accurate.
How exactly is he manipulating the water on a physical level to achieve that kind of containment?
Well, we have to look at the actual physics of water on a microscopic level.
Okay, let's zoom in.
Water doesn't flow by magic, and it certainly doesn't flow by pure chance. It follows the path of least resistance.
Right. Gravity and surface tension.
Exactly. In watercolor painting, that path is dictated exactly by where the artist has previously wet the paper with a clean brush.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because of surface tension, water will flow up to the exact millimeter where the wet paper meets the dry paper.
And then it just stops.
It stops dead. At that boundary, the hydrogen bonds in the water create a microscopic meniscus. It forms this invisible dam.
Oh, wow.
So when the artist floods an area with liquid pigment, he has already dictated the exact inescapable borders of that flood.
He's literally building invisible walls before the color even touches the page.
Precisely. And let's look at the specific chemistry of the paints he chose to drop inside those invisible walls.
Right, the materials.
He is using Daniel Smith brand watercolors. And in the material science of art, these are famous for their heavy mineral composition.
So they aren't just normal dyes?
No, we're not talking about synthetic dyes that merely stain the paper evenly. We're talking about genuine crushed minerals.
Like actual rocks?
Yes. Things like hematite, lapis lazuli, or, you know, specialized synthetic granulating compounds. They leave physical heavy residue.
Yeah, I'm picturing that.
Now, connect that to the cold-pressed Arches paper we discussed earlier.
Right, the 300-gram paper.
Cold press means the paper was squeezed through cold metal rollers during manufacturing, which leaves a heavy texture.
Ah, so it's not smooth.
No, it's full of microscopic valleys and crests. It's essentially a tiny, rugged mountain range on the page.
So you have a highly textured surface taking on crushed rocks.
Exactly. When the artist introduces these heavy mineral pigments into his perfectly contained puddles, gravity just takes over.
Right.
The heavy particles intentionally settle out of the water and fall into those microscopic valleys in the paper's texture.
And that creates a specific look.
Yes, it creates a stunning visual effect of granulation. It looks wildly organic, mimicking the random textures of nature, but it is a highly calculated physical reaction.
Because he chose those specific materials.
Exactly. He knows exactly how that specific chemical brand of paint will react with the physical topography of that specific cotton paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The level of physical engineering happening on a microscopic level is undeniable. I'll give you that.
It's intense, right?
It is. But I have to challenge this idea of him being an absolute dictator of the elements.
Okay, challenge away.
If he is entirely in control, you know, if every drop of water and every heavy mineral particle is settling exactly where he intended,
yeah,
then why does the final piece feel so deliberately uncomfortable?
Uncomfortable is an interesting reaction. Where are you feeling that discomfort when you look at it?
Oh, I mean, the piece just doesn't offer any peace. When artists are master manipulators of their materials, they traditionally use that supreme control to create harmony, right? They balance the composition to please the eye.
Typically, yes.
But 126 is not harmonious. It is tense. It's visually loud and combative. So if he is dictating every move through this hydrodynamic manipulation, why is he intentionally choosing to engineer such a visual struggle?
Answering that requires us to zoom out significantly.
Okay, let's step back.
We have to pull our focus away from the microscopic valleys of the paper and examine the macro architecture of the entire 11 by 15 inch space.
The big picture.
Yes. The discomfort you are feeling is not a byproduct of chaotic water. I mean, it is an architectural decision designed to force your eye into constant motion.
Wait, so the tension itself is the structural design?
Yes, absolutely. Look at the rigid geometry of the piece. There is a massive diagonal line that fractures the entire surface of the composition.
Yeah, you can't miss it.
And water, left to its own random fluid movement, does not naturally create perfect diagonal bisectors across a rectangle.
No, it makes puddles.
Right. So that diagonal is an act of extreme structural design. It's a calculated fracture meant to generate the exact psychological tension you're reacting to.
The diagonal is a highly deliberate slice right through the composition.
Yes. And look at the visual information happening on either side of that slice.
The colors.
Exactly. This is where Johannes Itten's color theory comes in, and it's applied with surgical precision.
Itten, the Bauhaus guy.
Yes. Itten was a master at the Bauhaus school, where art was analyzed with absolute scientific rigor. On one side of this diagonal, you have an intense, aggressive block of warm colors.
Yellows, oranges, deep reds.
Right. And on the other side, an equally aggressive block of cool colors. Blues and deep violets.
And they just hit each other. It's a total clash, completely lacking a transition zone.
And that clash is rooted in the literal biology of how human beings perceive the physics of light.
Wait, biology?
Yes. Warm colors like reds and oranges possess long wavelengths of light. When those long wavelengths enter the human eye, the lens actually has to physically bulge to focus them on the retina.
The lens physically changes shape.
It does. And this biological adjustment makes warm colors appear to physically advance or pop out at the viewer.
Wow. Okay. And the cool colors?
Cool colors, like blues, have short wavelengths. They focus slightly in front of the retina, causing the lens to flatten, which makes those colors appear to recede or sink backward into space.
So he is literally manipulating the biological mechanics of the viewer's eye.
He absolutely is. He isn't blending these colors to create a pleasant zen harmony for someone's living room wall.
Clearly not.
No, he is jamming a color that biologically advances right up against a color that biologically recedes. He's engineering a three-dimensional visual collision on a completely flat, two-dimensional piece of paper.
A three-dimensional visual collision.
Yes.
Okay, the physics of the color temperatures pushing and pulling against each other makes total sense.
Right.
But I have an entirely different read on that diagonal line, though.
Oh.
Yeah, you are framing it as an architectural grid. You see it as the rigid blueprint that holds the tension together.
Well, it acts as the necessary structural support for the color theory to function.
I don't see it as a structural grid, and I certainly don't see it as a cage holding the colors in.
Mm.
I view that diagonal as a deliberate tectonic fault line.
A fault line implies an impending disaster rather than a structural foundation, doesn't it?
That is exactly the point.
Okay, explain.
The artist understands the physics of the warm and cool colors. He knows they possess different wavelengths and that they are going to violently push and pull against each other biologically.
Nice.
Right? So he intentionally triggers an earthquake by drawing that diagonal fault line.
An earthquake?
Yeah. He cracks the earth, not to control the fallout,
yeah,
but simply so he can sit back and observe how the color temperatures collapse, bleed, and fight around that sudden rupture.
I see.
He acts as an instigator of chaos, not a manager of it. I mean, if his goal was total control and structural harmony, he would have softened the edge.
True, he could have.
He would have mixed a little of the warm orange into the cool blue to make the transition digestible for us. But he refuses to do that.
Mm.
She leaves the wound open and lets the elements fight it out.
Well, viewing the diagonal as an instigated rupture rather than a strict boundary is a really fascinating perspective.
Thank you.
And I will grant that the clash between the temperatures is left intentionally raw and unmediated.
Right.
But to truly test whether this artist is attempting to cage the chaos or let it run completely free, we have to examine the very last layer applied to the piece.
Oh, you mean the final sparse black lines floating over the top, the
yeah,
watercolor?
Yes. Those lines are the ultimate proof of the artist's intent.
See, I think those black lines completely validate the tectonic fault line theory.
Really?
Yeah. They validate the idea of the artist ultimately surrendering. In fact, the artist himself refers to these lines in his writing as the remains of a figuration that never quite appears.
The remains of a figuration.
Yeah, they're ghosts. They're fragmented, broken little suggestions of structure.
Broken suggestions.
Right. They do not trap the color like the bold, continuous outline of a comic book character. Because they are broken and sparse, they absolutely refuse to establish any fixed visual hierarchies.
Okay, I follow your logic.
They allow the fluid watercolor underneath to keep breathing, you know, to keep moving in the viewer's mind. They offer just a mere suggestion of form in a space that is otherwise totally liberated.
I will admit, reading them as ghosts of structure has a certain poetic resonance.
It does, doesn't it?
But if we connect this to the broader context of the artist's own text, well, there is a massive contradiction we cannot ignore.
What's the contradiction?
You call them ghosts, but the artist also explicitly refers to these exact same black lines as marks of containment.
Marks of containment. That phrase is definitely in his notes.
Right. Think about the underlying psychology of the word containment.
Okay.
You only seek to contain something when you harbor a fear that it's going to overflow and destroy the structure you have built.
A fear of overflow.
Yes. My argument is that the artist set up this massive contrasting color clash. He watched the water and the heavy mineral granulation doing their violent work, and he suddenly felt the profound vertigo of total abstraction.
You think he panicked?
I do. He saw the structure slipping away, he panicked, and he pulled the emergency brake.
A panic response to the physics of his own materials.
He had to intervene to save the structural integrity of the piece. I mean, water flowing through random fluid movement will never naturally dry into a sharp, opaque, geometric black line.
You know, definitely not.
So the introduction of those lines is an explicit, forceful act of human will. It is slapped on top of the organic chaos to declare, stop, the experiment is over, I am still the architect here.
Okay, I heavily disagree with this clinical psychological reading of the word containment.
Why is that?
Because equating containment with martial law or a desperate panic to save a sinking ship, I think it strips the artist of his nuance. Yeah. Containment does not have to be a rigid cage or an emergency brake. Think about a wildly passionate, loud conversation between a group of close friends.
Okay, picture a dinner party.
Right. Everyone is talking over each other. Complex ideas are clashing. The energy is incredibly high. It is chaotic.
Conversations of that nature can certainly border on chaos.
Exactly. And if the dialogue gets a little too tangled, someone might raise their hand and say, hold on, let's pause for a single second, just to gather a coherent thought.
Right.
That raised hand does not mean they're terrified of the conversation.
It's true.
It does not mean they want to permanently silence the room. It is just a temporary pause to establish a tiny bit of grounding.
I see where you're going.
A fragmented black line in this painting is simply the artist raising his hand in the middle of a screaming visual discussion.
Interesting.
He is saying, pause here, before letting the chaotic biological dialogue of the warm and cool colors resume. The lion is a punctuation mark, not a prison wall.
A punctuation mark.
Yeah.
Wow, that metaphor implies an ongoing, respectful dialogue with the material rather than a need for absolute dominion over it.
Exactly.
That is a subtle distinction, but a very powerful one to consider. Even if I firmly maintain that the deliberate placement of those opaque lines is an act of undeniable human control.
Which it is.
Right. I can concede that their fragmented nature prevents them from entirely strangling the life out of the fluid pigment beneath them.
They are forced to coexist.
Yes.
The structural design and the random chaos are in the arena together, and neither one manages to secure a knockout blow.
Which brings our debate to a rather fascinating synthesis, actually.
How so?
Despite our fundamental disagreement over the exact ratio of control versus surrender, we both arrive at the exact same conclusion regarding the ultimate power of 126.
Its greatest strength lies in its obstinately unresolved nature.
Exactly. It actively denies you the comfort of an easy resolution.
It really does.
This is not a piece of passive decorative art meant to seamlessly fade into the background of a domestic space. It demands your active attention through its inherent unresolved friction.
Whether you view that friction as a brilliant mathematically calculated equation of color theory and hydrodynamics,
or you view it as a brave, vulnerable surrender to the raw, untamable physics of the universe,
the end result is exactly the same.
It is.
It's an incredibly demanding experience that forces you to engage with the materials on their own terms.
And this brings us to the core takeaway for you today. Art is rarely just about what is painted.
Right.
We are so often conditioned to look for a recognizable face, a familiar landscape, or a clear narrative story. But 126 strips all of that away to remind us that how something is painted is an entire narrative in itself.
The materials themselves have a voice.
They do.
When you start looking closely at the literal foundation, you know, the dense trampoline-like sizing of the 300-gram arches paper, the heavy crushed minerals dragging themselves into the microscopic valley.
The invisible walls built by surface tension.
Yes. And the biological assault of long and short wavelengths on your eyes, it completely changes how you experience the work.
Completely.
You are no longer just looking at a flat picture.
Mm-hmm.
You are witnessing a violent physical event that has been frozen in time.
Ultimately, when you stand in front of those colliding color temperatures and trace the stark black lines floating on top of the organic stains, the interpretation is entirely yours.
Yeah, it's up to you.
It is up to you to decide what you are witnessing. Are you seeing the exact millisecond an artist bravely loses control to the elemental forces?
Mm.
Or are you seeing the exact millisecond they decisively choose to take the power back?
That's the question. And exploring a physical art laboratory, California, leaves us with something deeply provocative to chew on in our own spaces.
Definitely.
When we face unpredictable, chaotic forces in our own lives, when the messy realities of the world start bleeding across our own carefully drawn lines, how do we respond?
It's a great question.
Are the boundaries and the fragmented containment lines we so desperately try to draw evidence of our failure to just let go and trust the process?
Ooh.
Or are those very lines the only things that give the chaos of our lives any recognizable meaning at all?
A profound question to take away from the arena. Thank you for joining the deep dive today.